Good morning. We're here for argument in first in the case of People versus Gutierrez. I want to advise the parties and audience that we are going to take a break in between the two cases so that the media can set up for their filming second. So we're ready to hear from the appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Michael Rourke. I'm the Assistant District Attorney for the Weld County District Attorney's Office, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this interlocutory appeal. My registration number is 28812. The issues for review by this court this morning are first, whether the trial court, following the motions hearing in this case, erred in concluding that the search warrant affidavit failed to establish probable cause for the search of Amalia Cerrillo's business. Second, whether the trial court erred in concluding that the good faith exception was inapplicable as no reasonable officer could have relied on this particular warrant. And third, whether the trial court erred in concluding that the particularity requirement was not satisfied by the affidavit and search warrant. The people are asking this court to reverse the trial court's conclusions on all three grounds. First, in the trial court's order analyzing the defendant's Fourth Amendment claims, the trial court's written order discusses what level of protection should be afforded to an individual's tax record. The trial court found that tax records in Colorado are confidential, however not privileged. People do not dispute that individuals generally have a reasonable expectation of privacy in tax records, which is the very reason that a search warrant was sought in the first instance in this case. However, to the extent that the trial court's order can be read to provide these kinds of records with some higher level of protection, the people do dispute that finding and would urge the court to find that the tax records should not be afforded any additional protections, such as those afforded to medical records, psychiatric records, or even school records.
Mr. Rourke, concerning that distinction, does it have any pertinence or any bearing on the issue in this case? In other words, is it even necessary to address whether they have a higher level of protection or concern, shall I say, than that's what is necessary for Fourth Amendment standing?
As it relates to this particular case, no, Your Honor. I don't believe that it has any bearing on, first of all, the trial court's findings that are the subject of the review, nor of this court's review of the trial court's findings.
Thank you.
On the issue of probable cause to issue a search warrant exists when there are sufficient facts contained within the affidavit which would cause a person of reasonable caution to believe the contraband or evidence of a crime is located within the area or the place to be searched. That was the holding of this court in the Henderson case. A probable cause determination does not lend itself to mathematical certainties and should not be laden with hyper-technical interpretations or rigid legal rules. Rather, the probable cause determination focuses on whether the affidavit establishes a fair probability that the officers executing the warrant will find evidence or contraband of a crime at the location to be searched. In the trial court's order, the trial court found that, quote, there are very few facts from which to arrive at a finding of probable cause. There are many statements attributed to Ms. Cerrillo for which no basis of knowledge has been established, end quote. It's the people's position that the trial court erred in this conclusion. The search warrant affidavit provided the reviewing district court judge with numerous facts from which a probable cause determination was made. Investigators learned from an individual named Servando Trejo that he had utilized the tax services of Ms. Cerrillo's business. He indicated that he had purchased a name and a social security number, had been working in Colorado under that assumed name and social security number, had taken his wage earning statements bearing that false name and social security number to Ms. Cerrillo for the purpose of obtaining a tax return. He told Ms. Cerrillo, according to the statements to investigators, that he was using this fraudulently obtained social security number and name for employment, and she assisted him in obtaining an individual tax identification number, which for brevity I will refer to as ITIN. These statements of Mr. Trejo were corroborated by investigators when they located copies of his tax returns, and in fact, he indicated that he had tax returns that were prepared by Mr. Rio, utilizing his real name and his ITIN number on the one hand, on the 1040 form, however, utilized the fictitious identity or false identity on the W-2.
I would like to ask a clarifying question on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, the tax preparer can use a separate number from the Social Security number for the purposes of the tax return, correct?
That's correct. That's okay. The ITIN.
So the crime is the false or misuse of the Social Security number?
That's correct.
All right. So did the state go after the employer matters concerning the misuse of the Social Security number, or did they go straight to this search warrant for all possible misuse of Social Security numbers?
The investigators in this case first sought the search warrant that is at issue before this court. In large part because of the nature of identity theft itself, the investigators didn't know what individuals were falsely using names and Social Security numbers. That was the information they were seeking from the place of business of Amalia Cirillo. After obtaining that information through the execution of this search warrant, then investigators took that information, went back to the employers at issue, and obtained things like the I-9 form, employment documentation, things like that as a result of the fruits of this search.
So what information here is in the affidavit and the search warrant having to do with this particular individual and possible need to have his records, at least for the purposes of investigating this crime?
There was no information in this affidavit about the defendant in this case in particular. The information that the investigators had, which is in the warrant, discusses the statements from Ms. Cirillo that she has a number of individuals who come to her business who indicate to her that they are using either a fictitious or otherwise false Social Security number and identity, and that she prepares the taxes for them, and also maintains a record of the individuals who come in and utilize her business. So the people's position is that there is no other source of information other than these tax records based on what was known to them at the time as to which particular individuals were in fact utilizing Social Security numbers and names of other individuals from the people's position in violation of the identity theft and criminal persons.
But it's correct that everything that she was doing was legal. I mean, both parties agree to that.
Everything that she was doing was in accordance with IRS guidelines.
Right.
Yes.
So there can be this odd dichotomy between creating an ITIN and then having income reported under a different name.
That's exactly right. And the IRS, in fact, has recently modified its procedures to allow for this type of an ITIN Social Security number mismatch to be electronically filed. They go so far also as to, once they've corrected this in their computer system or their e-file capabilities, they used to send a letter notifying the true owner, if you will, of the Social Security number and the name, that their information had been utilized by another individual on another at another location. Because now they have the ability to accept these filings and the wages earned are attributed to the person with the ITIN, the IRS no longer sends notification to the owner of that Social Security number, if you will. So all of the people that we allege had been the victim of identity theft out of this investigation had no idea that their Social Security number was being utilized by other individuals.
Well, you, for your crime of criminal impersonation, though, you must show that this was a real valid Social Security number assigned to somebody else. Isn't that right?
I think that's accurate, Your Honor, for the crime of identity theft, because right. We have to show that it belongs to a person. For the crime of criminal impersonation, our read of the statute is that if somebody completely makes up a Social Security number, utilizes that Social Security number, and derives a benefit from that, that is a violation of the criminal impersonation statute as well.
So your probable cause analysis goes to both those crimes?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Before you get going again, Mr. Rourke, I'm still a little confused about the way this works and what the tax preparer is doing and why that doesn't amount to complicity in the commission of a crime, and exactly how these two sets of information work so that the federal government pays a tax return, but it doesn't involve disclosure of this identity theft along the way. Could you explain the sequence here and what the tax preparer does?
I could try. Okay. According to IRS guidelines, there is a whole series of internal policies dealing with the issuance of an individual tax identification number for individuals for certain purposes. One of them is the filing of a tax return, whether or not the income was obtained legally or illegally. ITINs can also be used for a whole host of other purposes, but not to work in the state of Colorado. So, hypothetically, or to answer the Your Honor's question, somebody would come into a tax preparer's office with a W-2 and a 1099 bearing the name of John Smith with some Social Security. The person, according to even Ms. Cerrillo's own statements, would say to her, I am utilizing this information to work under this assumed identity. I don't want my employer to know because either I don't want to get fired or be reported to the immigration authorities. But I want to file for a tax return. IRS procedures allow for that to happen. Whether or not the information is obtained lawfully and whether or not that Social Security number matches the information on the 1040.
When you say they allow for that to happen, what exactly do you mean? Do they provide a defense for complicity in using somebody else's identity to get money from the federal government?
The IRS takes the position that first of all, is not a violation of any federal law and, in fact, is in compliance with IRS guidelines. This is how the IRS has set up this procedure to get this money.
And you mean that the acquisition of the ITIN is not in violation of the law. Is that right?
That's correct, and nor is the filing of a tax return with an ITIN on a 1040 form and utilizing a W-2 with someone else's Social Security number and name.
And do you all understand that to provide a defense to a state crime, if there is one, about using somebody else's name and Social Security number to get money?
I think it could. In the way that this investigation progressed, to be very candid, we never got to the point of being able to analyze that particular part because we were dealing with the records that were seized.
Well, to go back to some of the questions that were earlier asked, it seems to be taken for granted, and you seem to be making a concession that you don't believe this is probable cause to believe the tax preparer was violating state law. Are you simply saying the tax preparer was not your target?
That's
or are you saying you think the tax preparer has a defense under state law such that this would not be probable cause?
I think that she would have a defense, and she was not the target of the initial investigation. The individuals utilizing the information and providing it to her was the target of the investigation. So therefore, the warrant was drafted in that fashion.
Okay.
But you used the word target. I think it's important that we stay with whether she was breaking the law or not. And from my reading of the briefs, it's your position that she was breaking no laws, state or federal, by filing the tax returns for these people.
That is the information that we relied upon, and that is the basis or our conclusion at the time that this warrant was issued, yes.
So you were preparing this warrant to go through her to get to people who, in your mind, were in fact breaking the law, not by filing their tax returns, but by earning income using a false identity.
That's correct.
Mr. Rourke, let me just focus that just a little more, and that is the people therefore agree that the affidavit does not state probable cause to believe the tax preparer was involved in any crime.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Could you go over the elements briefly of the crime you're talking about and explain why you don't think that is probable cause?
I think that while the elements may be established, and the elements of identity theft are that a person knowingly uses the personal identifying information of another to obtain a benefit for themselves, and of course I'm paraphrasing. I think that while a complicity theory could fit, the business would have a compelling argument, at least in front of a jury, that I was doing everything that I was supposed to do as a tax preparer under the IRS guidelines that I am given under which to operate. I think that would be the defense that we could anticipate at a trial should she ever be charged with complicity to commit identity theft or criminal persecution.
I'm sorry, would you just say that again one time?
The part about the defense?
Yes.
I think that the jury would be told, at least from a jury nullification standpoint, perhaps, which...
Well, that wouldn't be a defense, right?
Wouldn't be a defense. But I think the jury would learn that the tax preparer was preparing these taxes that are at issue in this warrant in accordance with IRS guidelines and procedures. Will I answer the court's question?
And then I guess what you're saying is if you were doing that within IRS procedures, that would be a defense to a state crime?
While not an affirmative defense, I think it would be information that the jury could consider.
Well, you don't have any evidence, at least there's nothing in the affidavit that would suggest that she was in any way complicit with the people who came to her to have their taxes filed, with their obtaining these Social Security numbers.
No, we had no information that she was providing the false or fictitious Social Security numbers or identities. And I think actually your Honor's question, Justice Rice, may answer the question that Justice Coates asked me, which is the theory of prosecution for one of these individuals would have been the utilization of a false or fictitious Social Security number in the course of their employment.
So really, I'm interrupting you, I beg your pardon. So it really wouldn't have had anything to do with them filing tax because their attempt to file tax returns was lawful.
That's correct. And so our theory would have been that the crime would have ended at the time that the taxes were filed. That would the act of filing the taxes would have been evidence of the act of criminal impersonation, which had occurred at a date prior to the time that they had filed.
Well, the crime would have ended at the time that they received any income using the Social Security number, irrespective of whether they paid taxes on it or not, right?
That's right.
So you were going to the tax preparer only to go backwards, if you will, to the beginning of the crime.
I think that's correct.
And you didn't have any reason to believe that the tax preparer was selling Social Security numbers or anything else, and she was just simply filing his tax returns. Okay.
May I ask one clarifying question then, not to get argumentative here, but that raises a sort of question about knowledge here when you talk about whether somebody was complicit or aiding. Are you saying, however, is the factual situation here that the tax preparer has knowledge that she is entering as this person's income for purposes of getting a refund, knowing that that person only got that income through the use of by committing identity theft?
Yes.
The use of somebody else's.
Yes, and I think we can attribute that knowledge to her based on her statements to investigators that these people tell me I am utilizing this false or fictitious Social Security number or identity to work, but I want to file taxes. That was her statement to investigators.
So at least, however we characterize this legally, I don't want to get too far off in an argument here, but at least in terms of the facts, what we've got is knowledge on the part of the tax preparer that she is including figures that this person is entitled to a refund based on her knowledge that the refund the person is entitled to actually is a refund in the name of a false identity taken from another person.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I know that we're sort of bouncing you back and forth. Apologize for that, but this whole process was set up by the IRS, is that right?
Yes.
That seems... Did they actually put out memos and whatnot describing that this is the way it was supposed to work? I mean, I think I read that in one of the briefs.
There are, in fact, IRS publications dealing with the utilization of an ITIN number as well as the procedures to be followed when the ITIN number does not match the wage earning information. Yes.
Okay.
The other issue that I would like to touch on very briefly is the good faith exception. I'm going to try to do so in fairly short order.
Who was the judge who signed that warrant? It was
Marcelo Kafka.
Okay, and he's a district court judge, right?
That's correct.
And how did it happen that he signed this particular warrant as opposed to a county court judge or magistrate?
The procedure in Weld County is simply when a law enforcement officer has a warrant to be signed, they go to the clerk's office. The clerk will call around to the various judicial officers to find out who's available. Judge Kafka happened to be available at the time.
Okay.
So there's not a preference for a county court judge versus a district court judge in the first instance. I think the important thing that I would like to highlight regarding the good faith exception is, as stated by this court in Altman, The officer's good faith in executing a signed warrant can only be impugned by showing that it would have been entirely unreasonable for the officer to have believed that the affidavit supported the issuance of a warrant. The people, based on all of the information that's contained in the warrant, and we disagree with the trial court's conclusion, that the statements from Mr. Trejo in the first instance and Ms. Cerillo were in fact conclusory statements. Rather, I think that their statements to law enforcement can be characterized as information from a firsthand observer, from an eyewitness. The trial court seemed to put very little stock in the fact that Ms. Cerillo certainly had a basis of knowledge for the statements that she was making, because she was certainly in a position where she would not only receive the statements from these individuals generally that she was talking about, but also could describe with, again, firsthand knowledge of the actions that she was taking.
Well, what was her firsthand information that someone other than her was doing this?
I'm sorry, that someone other than Ms. Cerillo was...
No, other than the informant, excuse me, him, I guess.
The firsthand information was the statement by Ms. Cerillo that she prepares these types.
No. I'm going back to your initial informant, Trejo. Yeah, Trejo. What was his information that someone other than him was doing this process of stealing, if you will, false identities? I don't want to go to the tax returns, because the only crime here is the stealing of the false identities. So what is his information that other people were doing this?
His information, according to what the investigators were able to determine, was a reputation type of information, if you will, that he worked in the agricultural community and that he knew or was told this is the place to go when you have a social security number belonging to somebody else and you want to file taxes. That's the information that originally turned investigators to focus on Ms. Cerillo's business.
But did he have names of other people who had stolen false identities?
He did not, that we were aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, while looking at the search warrant now, the theory upon which it was obtained would equally apply, would it not, to any employer? I mean, you could allege, or the affiant could allege, that employers are out there probably employing people or using false numbers. So actually, any employer could be targeted with the same kind of search warrant if your theory of this case is upheld. Is that right?
That's correct, because I think that the basis of the warrant, as Your Honor indicates, would be the employer has information that this person employed by them is utilizing a false or fictitious identity.
Or somebody. So then that warrant would allow any employer's office to be inspected and the records taken away and copied.
If we had the type of information that people believe formed probable cause to get...
That is, that there may be a crime going on.
Yes.
So on your good faith argument, isn't it true that when the warrant was executed, the officers went beyond the terms of the warrant, which would give lie somewhat to this concept of good faith?
I think as it relates to Mr. Gutierrez, no. They did not go beyond the terms or scope of the warrant. In fact, the documents that were seized were 2006 tax returns. In other cases, I think as the court saw in the trial court's order, there were other documents seized that fell outside the scope of the warrant. But as we haven't had an opportunity to litigate that in front of a trial court, I'm not sure if we have a basis.
If that were true, and I understand you're not maybe in a position to even answer this question and say so if that's the case, but if that were true, it certainly would be problematic with respect to good faith, wouldn't it?
Unless there was reliance upon another exception to the warrant requirement, such as plain view.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Merson. I represent Ramon Gutierrez in this appeal. We're asking the court to affirm the trial court's order, the suppression of evidence in this case, and to find that this was in fact a bare bones affidavit and that the good faith exception does not apply to the search in this case. First of all, regarding probable cause, as the court noted a few moments ago, there's not any indication in the affidavit or the four corners of the affidavit in support of the search warrant with respect to what percentage or amount of Amalia's clientele is this particular demographic. In other words, people that were filing for ITIN numbers after they had previously used the Social Security number and used the W-7 form, which is the form that is sent to the IRS when a ITIN number is requested, and filing taxes after that. There's never any indication at any point in the affidavit that Mr. Gutierrez was doing this. As a matter of fact, nobody knew anything about Mr. Gutierrez's taxes or anything about him until his file was opened at Amalie's. There was not any information about him at all with respect to what demographic he represented at Amalie's business. And there's not any information in the search warrant. There's not any inferences that can be drawn from any of the statements from either the informant in this case or Amalie for that matter.
Counsel, could I stop you there and just ask you, what do you think would be required to satisfy the dictates of probable cause? What kind of information, in your view, is missing?
Well, specific information concerning this warrant could have satisfied probable cause if there was more information regarding the specifics as to who was using these ITIN numbers and the false Social Security numbers at Amalie's. What percentage of people were doing that?
Well, that's the part I'm curious about. What does the percentage get you? You're focused on the percentage as opposed to a name. I mean, I guess I hear your argument that you're actually not requiring a name. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. I think a name might be required. More information is required is what I'm ultimately getting at here.
Okay, but I'm trying to push you a little harder on what that information might look like.
Okay, information that the police officers obtained after they executed the search warrant in this case. Information from an employer that a particular employee is using a Social Security number that's not theirs and does not belong to them, and that they file taxes at Amalie's. That might be enough information to execute a search warrant and to have the sufficient amount of probable cause to execute that warrant. Does that answer your question?
Well, so getting back to the percentage, though, how would that help?
Well, I guess I don't know. I suppose you can envision a scenario. I'm still thinking under the general warrant sort of scenario, and it's possible that a general warrant could be upheld. I don't know if in these circumstances it could ever be upheld. Perhaps it could, and maybe that's why I brought up the percentages, because if someone was able to say with some amount of certainty that would establish probable cause that 100% of the people at Amalie's are filing taxes and she services exclusively this demographic and nobody else, maybe in that scenario there might be probable cause if an inference can be drawn that whoever is providing that information has a basis for knowledge that everyone that goes to Amalie's is using this fake Social Security numbers. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Can I ask you one thing just about where you're going with that then? It sounds like you're not contesting that there was probable cause to believe evidence of a crime would be found somewhere in the files of this tax preparer. You're just arguing that the information had to be more specific about where that probable cause was located. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Gutierrez's sphere of privacy, his expectation of privacy in his tax files were violated when the Wellcanny Sheriff's deputies that were executing the search warrant went through his tax information. And previous to doing that, they didn't have any information to establish or to believe that Mr. Gutierrez had violated any statutes. They didn't know anything about him. So with respect to interfering with his specific sphere of privacy, his expectation of privacy, that's what I'm getting at.
Let me just pose that. So it does sound to me like you're answering my question affirmatively. You're not saying there wasn't probable cause to believe the tax preparer's files would show evidence of would be probable cause of a crime. It's just that you're saying they had to, before going through an individual's file, they had to particularize the probable cause to his file.
Exactly, and it has to do with the particularity requirement and the fact that basically a trial court, Judge Kotka, that signed the warrant in this case, authorized a inventory search, essentially, and gave the police officers too much discretion. It's inevitable that police officers will have some amount of discretion whenever they're executing a search warrant, but there is a point at which there's too much discretion, and that's the purpose behind the particularity requirement. That's the purpose behind limiting the scope of the search, and that wasn't present in this case.
If we had, for instance, a house with a number of people living there, and the police had probable cause, and the issuing magistrate was, you know, faced with an affidavit that showed probable cause to believe there was a murder weapon in this house, but we couldn't pinpoint which of these people it belonged to, would that nevertheless justify a search of the house?
Yes, it would. But I think that what plays into the calculus there is whose privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment are being violated and whether or not there's probable cause to violate those privacy rights, which is the issue in this case. We have Mr. Gutierrez's expectation of privacy in his tax information and whether or not there's probable cause to enter into that sphere of privacy that he has a reasonable expectation of.
Well, would that, would the analogy, if carried out, then be you saying they'd need probable cause to know whose dresser it was likely in or whose particular property it was likely in, or otherwise they'd be violating the privacy of any individual?
Not necessarily. I think that ultimately it would depend upon several things. In your analogy, who's living in the house? Is there someone that's renting a bedroom? And is that person the only person that has access to that particular bedroom? Is it sort of a communal living arrangement like a family? And those are the questions that would need to be asked in that situation that would ultimately get you to who has an expectation of privacy as to where the search was done.
So the analogy to a separate room or dresser here for you would be the file. If it's a file with this individual's name on it, that's separate and distinct and can't be looked at without particularized suspicion as to that file.
Without particularized probable cause, the police officers in this case did not have a right to invade Mr. Gutierrez's Fourth Amendment expectation of
and
privacy.
I'll stop monopolizing you with just one more question here. To carry that one step further then to those cases where we do have searches of, say, an attorney's office or something like that, Andreessen versus Maryland and those. What's the distinction you're seeing here between the allowance in those cases to search through the files to find out which one contains the illegal information?
Well, I think the distinction between Andreessen versus Maryland in this case is that Andreessen versus Maryland involved a real estate attorney, and the police officers that were investigating that crime, they only zoned in on one specific suspect, and it wasn't a general warrant in the sense that they were looking for as much information as possible concerning as many possible suspects as possible. They thought that this particular real estate attorney was involved in fraud. And also, if you look at the search warrant that the district court signed in that case, it was limited. It was limited in scope. And it didn't give the police officers that were executing the warrant the amount of discretion the police officers had in this case. It was only limited, I believe it was a lot, 13 T's, the information they were looking for in that case. And the search warrant only allowed the police officers to get information regarding lot 13 T, and that's it. Which is different in this case. In this case, the police officers were permitted to seize 5,000, well, until the suppression order, the police officers were permitted to seize 5,000 different tax files, intrude upon 5,000 different zones of privacy, and I'm not trying to assert anyone else's privacy rights except for Mr. Gutierrez's, but I'm just trying to answer your question that before they entered Mr. Gutierrez's expectation of privacy, they didn't have any information about him or anything that he had done wrong. So those are the distinctions I would draw between Andreessen versus Maryland in this case.
But regardless of the number of other files, as you started to say there, that they were able to look at, and that being a problem, your argument is it wouldn't make any difference if it was just two files even. They have to have particularized suspicion with regard to your client's particular file before they could look in that file. Is that right?
Yes, and the reason for that is because Mr. Gutierrez had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that file. Title 26 of the Income Tax Code insulates income tax information that goes to the IRS from all the other federal branches of government. Tax preparers, people working for the IRS are subject to civil and criminal liability if they disclose that information. Mr. Gutierrez's only expectation when he gave that tax information to his tax preparer was that his tax preparer would turn it over to the IRS and nobody else would ever see it. And that's a reasonable expectation of privacy. And the policy behind Title 26 is that the purpose of that is to give people incentive to file their taxes so that more revenue will be generated in the IRS. And that same policy, that's the very reason why the IRS came up with the system for allowing people to file taxes when they have a Social Security number that's mismatched with an ITIN. The IRS probably realized that they're missing out on a lot of revenue here. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Would you just take that a step further then you're saying the IRS can't turn it over to the FBI or somebody else to investigate the employer and whether the employer is complicit? There is a zone of expectation that the this information won't be used for any other purpose other than the taxing purpose. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a refund. It's very, very possible the person owes taxes, I mean,
exactly.
As well.
Well, and historically, Title 26 and the legislation I was referring to a minute ago came about shortly after the Nixon administration. And part of the reason, and the Stokowitz decision actually talks about this, is the IRS was basically a lending library, I think is what they called it, and they were giving this information out to all of these other federal branches. And the IRS wanted Title 26 to be more, to insulate the IRS from the other federal branches so that they could take in more of this money and give people incentive to report their taxes, because they were missing out on that, on all that money. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
You couldn't, for example, serve this warrant on the IRS. I mean, think about it that way. Is that correct?
Well, absolutely not.
So why is it so clear that you could absolutely not serve this on the IRS when we're having an argument about whether you could serve this warrant on this tax repair?
Well, because the same policy behind Title 26 that insulates the IRS from disclosing this information to the federal branches is what gives Mr. Gutierrez that reasonable expectation of privacy in his tax files, which means that law enforcement searching through those tax files can only do that if they have probable cause to believe that within his specific zone of privacy under the Fourth Amendment, he's violated some sort of law. Does that answer your question? One thing that I did want to talk about was the good faith exception, of course. And I think, first of all, what I want to touch on is historically, this court has previously ruled that there's not necessarily a privacy interest in tax records, but if you look at the case law concerning Charnes versus Giacomo and Sporletter and also Core, those were cases that dealt with telephone taps where the police officers reported where calls were being made to. I think that's Core and Sporletter. Mm. And then with respect to Charnes versus Giacomo, that's a case that extended the Article 2, Section 7 privacy rights under the Colorado Constitution beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court authorized.
Is that basically what you're urging us to do, is to find an independent, adequate state ground, or is yours really a Fourth Amendment case?
Well, yes, I'm asking for both, actually. I'm asking for the court to rule that under the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, Mr. Gutierrez had a reasonable expectation of privacy, and that also under Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution, Mr. Gutierrez had an expectation of privacy. I think that based upon the precedent, the court, if the court is going to follow precedent, the court needs to rule that way. In Charnes versus Giacomo, that dealt with a situation where this court overruled the U.S. Supreme Court in U.S. v. Miller. U.S. v. Miller had established that a person does not have an expectation of privacy in their bank records. And I believe that was mid-70s. And then Charnes versus Giacomo came out from this court in 1980. And this court explicitly rejected the logic from U.S. v. Miller and said, you know what, Article 2, Section 7 goes further than the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1984, People v. Core came down from this court, and that was a case that involved a search warrant where police officers had tapped into a particular person's phone line to determine which calls they were making. And in part of that decision, the court dealt with the good faith exception. And in dealing with the good faith exception, the court said, and again reiterated this in People v. Randolph, that police officers have an independent professional duty to exercise reasonable judgment in each stage of the proceedings. And they have an independent duty, aside from the trial court, aside from the district attorneys, to have a reasonable understanding of the law. And the court ruled in People v. Core, this court ruled in People v. Core, that the police officers that execute the warrant in that case should have been aware that Article 2, Section 7 in Colorado provides greater privacy rights than what the U.S. Constitution provides.
Mr. Merson,
yes.
Let me ask you a question about that. It's true the trial court in this case used both constitutions, and you did argue that in your brief. But what we're really talking about here is a right of privacy that emanates for federal tax returns, aren't we?
Well,
and isn't that really what's at issue? Now, they're filed with the state, but we're really talking about federal statutes that protect both tax preparer and the identity and the information of the taxing of the person filing the tax, right?
That's correct. We're talking about federal statutes, but what I'm saying is
I understand. You're saying we should extend under our Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution the right of privacy based on earlier cases,
yes,
right?
That's correct.
But I'm saying, isn't that inconsistent with this case because it deals with a federal confidential requirements, and if not, why not?
Not necessarily. I don't think it's inconsistent, Your Honor, because all that the court would be saying by reaffirming the trial court's order in this case is that anyone that's filing federal income taxes in Colorado has an expectation of privacy under the Colorado Constitution. If a person is filing federal income taxes in Nebraska or Kansas, they might not have that same expectation of privacy with respect to the tax preparation person or the accountant that they give their taxes to. But if they're filing in Colorado, they do under Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution.
Now that confuses me now. Why in another state that maybe doesn't have this state constitutional protection, and I'm not sure I know what state that is, but assuming that that exists, why wouldn't a person in that state have the same expectation of privacy based on the IRS protection and federal protection of tax records?
What I'm saying is that in Colorado, if a person is filing income taxes, whether that be to the Colorado Department of Revenue or to the federal government, under Article 2, Section 7, they have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those documents, whether they're at the tax preparation office or their accountant's office.
So your point is just there's an expectation of privacy regardless of what state you're in. If you're in Colorado, that's also founded on the Colorado Constitution.
Exactly.
Now, I was going to ask you earlier sort of what difference it makes, because the people, as I understand it, agree that there's an expectation of privacy for Fourth Amendment purposes. I suspect they would also agree that they would probably argue that Colorado affords no greater expectation, but I doubt they would argue that there isn't an expectation under Colorado Constitution as well. So my question becomes, why do we need to address anything beyond that since the people agree? And I think you went over sort of quickly, but I think your point you're trying to make is that there might be a difference in terms of the good faith exception analysis if the expectation is under the Colorado Constitution and if the Colorado Constitution affords greater protection.
Right.
Is that your argument?
And that's part of, yes.
Now, I will ask that you repeat why it is that the good faith exception would be different under those two constitutions, or that analysis would be different. That went by a little quickly, and I just want you to repeat that.
Let me try and, I think it's best to go over the analysis in People v. Gore. That's a case that came out in 1984. Charnes versus Diacomo came out in 1980. Both of those decisions were Colorado Supreme Court decisions. Mm-hmm. In Diacomo, that's the case that dealt with bank records. Gore dealt with a police officer putting some sort of electronic device on a phone and determining where those calls were being made to and getting a search warrant to do that. And this court, first of all, ruled that there was not probable cause for that police officer to do that. Also in that opinion, in the Gore opinion, this court analyzed whether or not good faith applied. And part of the, I don't know if it was a district attorney or attorney general, they had argued that there wasn't any case law to establish that precedent. And what this court stated in that opinion, the core opinion, was that while the police officers had a reasonable duty to be aware of the fact that the Colorado Supreme Court had previously ruled in 1980 in Charnes versus Diacomo, Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution provides a greater expectation of privacy. That's part of the analysis that I was wanting this court to adapt that was adopted.
So the point is simply that if we are to find that the Colorado Constitution creates a greater protection of the privacy interests involved here than the United States Constitution, which we have done in other arenas but haven't done in this particular arena, obviously, then if we did so in this opinion, then that would raise the standard for determining that there's good faith because law enforcement should understand that the Colorado Constitution affords even greater protection, and so the good faith that they would have with regard to the U.S. Constitution somehow wouldn't be quite enough. They'd need a little bit more.
Well, I think that the case law says that police officers are required to have a reasonable understanding of the law and a reasonable understanding of what the Fourth Amendment allows and doesn't allow, and I would assume that that means that if police officers are in Colorado executing a search warrant, that also means that the police officers should have some awareness as to what is or is not permitted in Colorado and what the Colorado courts have established is allowed or not allowed, not only under the Fourth Amendment, but also Article 2, Section 7. Another thing regarding good faith that I just want to briefly touch upon is that whether or not the deterrent effect of the exclusionary rule would be furthered here. And I think that it would, because the police officers in this case basically executed an open-ended inventory search. That's not the first time that this has happened, but there have been many other instances in the past when there has been that sort of open-ended search where the police officers have just sort of unlimited discretion to seize whatever they want. And courts, this court has previously ruled that the deterrent effect is furthered by finding that good faith does not apply in those circumstances.
Can I ask you one quick follow-up about, since you're dwelling on Charn so much and Swarlitter and Core in this line?
Yes.
Did we ever say anything in there to suggest that the bank wouldn't have to turn over its records to the state if there were probable cause to believe it had evidence of a crime? In effect, didn't we say only there that we were disagreeing with the U.S. Supreme Court about whether the individual had an expectation of privacy such that he could expect the bank not to turn those records over without probable cause?
That's exactly right.
But was there any, in any of those three cases, was there any suggestion about the narrowness to the individual that you're talking about here?
No, there was not. And the court, you're correct. In those situations, the Colorado Supreme Court did not determine whether or not probable cause existed as to that specific individual. It was just whether or not there was probable cause in Charns. Whether or not there was a privacy interest with respect to those bank records. That's correct.
Thank you.
I think that ultimately what Mr. Rourke had called a higher level of protection is just a reasonable level of protection, and that's what Mr. Gutierrez is asking for here. Just a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to his income taxes, his income tax information that he gave to his tax preparer, and that he reasonably thought under Title 26 would only be given to the IRS by his tax preparer and nobody else. And that's a reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think that his expectation of privacy is even more reasonable than that in Charns, for example, because in Charns, there was a situation where there's bank records. So presumably the information on the bank records is information that had come from some sort of negotiable instrument or at some point had been in the streams of commerce. If I went down to Safeway and wrote a check for some milk, I had surrendered an interest of some sort of expectation of privacy in the information that's on that check and whoever saw that check before it made it to my bank. But in Charns, the court ruled that there's an expectation of privacy even in that information. So if there's an expectation of privacy in that, I think there especially should be one here. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.